From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Wednesday when presidential candidate Jeb Bush sat down for a conversation with a conservative editorial board of the New Hampshire Union Leader. He was asked about how the economy can improve. His answer, in part, included his assertion that Americans need to work longer hours. Taken out of context, it looked like a gaffe. Left-leaning columnists complained that Bush was calling American workers lazy. Right-leaning columnists defended his remarks, saying that the critics were missing the point. And so Jeb Bush clarified his comments. We will play his comments to you in their entirety in just a moment. This hour, we examine the state of the American workforce. Do Americans need to work longer hours? Did Jeb Bush offer an important point, especially when comparing part-time workers to full-time workers? My guests for the hour include Kent Gardner, the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Kent, nice to have you again.
Hi, Evan.
Sean Sutton's here, the chair of political science at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Sean, nice to have you.
Thanks.
Also here is Aaron Young, lead organizer for the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation. Aaron, nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Bertolone is in studio, president of the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation and AFL-CIO. Jim, how are you?
Good. Good to be here, Evan.
And we expect to hear from at least one of the leaders in the local business community on the line, and we'll bring them in when we have that for you. I want to start by going with the full comments here. It's easy to sort of try to take something out of context. I want to listen to what Jeb Bush said. First of all, this is him in the first iteration talking to the New Hampshire union leader about fixing the economy.
My aspiration for the country, and I believe we can achieve it, is 4% growth as far as the eye can see, which means we have to be a lot more productive. Workforce participation has to rise from its all-time modern lows. It means that people need to work longer hours and through their productivity gain more income for their families. That's the only way we're going to get out of this rut that we're in.
All right, so that's Jeb Bush, and almost immediately there was some reaction. And so very quickly, he and the campaign met with the media. He wanted to clarify what he meant. Let's listen to Jeb Bush.
If we're going to grow the economy, people need to be stop being part-time workers. They need to be having access to greater opportunities to work. Look, under this administration, they have created rules that make it harder for people to work. This overtime rule is going to end up creating not more opportunities, higher income for people. People are going to end up working less. Obamacare has forced people to businesses to hire people for 30 hours rather than 40 hours. You can take it out of context all you want, but high sustained growth means that people work 40 hours rather than 30 hours, and that by our success, they have money, disposable income for their families to decide how they want to spend it rather than getting in line and being dependent upon government.
And then it became a Twitter feud, as all things do now. Hillary Clinton tweeted, "Anyone who believes Americans aren't working hard enough hasn't met enough American workers." And the chairman of her campaign, John Podesta, also weighed in on Twitter saying, quote, "Americans are working pretty hard already and don't need to work longer hours. They need to get paid more." Jeb Bush tweeted back, "Anyone who discounts 6.5 million people stuck in part-time work and seeking full-time jobs hasn't listened to working Americans." Jim Bertolone and Aaron Young, we spoke briefly last week, and I know that Aaron, you in particular, you weren't really buying his explanation, but he said, look, when he clarified his comment, it was about part-time versus full-time. Do you buy that?
Well, I mean, nobody can ignore the statistics or the percentages involving part-time versus full-time workers in this country. I disagree with what he's saying as far as adjusting the overtime rules would give employers incentive to turn part-time people into full-time employees, not the other way around. We cannot ignore the kind of what has put us in this spot, okay, in the first place, and what employers have done to continuously increase their bottom line at the expense of workers' wages. We have to talk about wage stagnation, the fact that nothing has changed to keep up with inflation, the fact that that workers' productivity levels have gone up, not down, nor have stayed the same. And many large corporations and businesses, their profit, it shows in their profits, which keep increasing. The American worker is not seeing any of that.
Jim Bertolone, AFL-CIO, where do you agree or disagree with Jeb Bush?
I can't find anywhere I agree, including his comments.
None of it?
Including his comments going back to the Iraq War. The intelligence was right. They lied.
So we're not adjudicating the Iraq War, thankfully, this hour, but go ahead.
Back, but he said Americans' productivity is down, and it is up, and it has gone up astronomically since the 70s. And where workers' wages used to go up with it, that line has been broken ever since Ronald Reagan. Stiglitz's last book, Joseph Stiglitz, economic Nobel laureate, said that in the last 10 years, 91% of all wealth created has gone to the top 1%. In fact, even a percentage of that 1%. There, and I haven't seen any statistics that there's been any huge change in the proportion of the workforce working part-time due to Obamacare. In fact, everything I read is in wealthy nations. Used to be the Japanese worked the most hours that year after year the last few years. We average about 47 hours a week and work more hours than the Japanese.
Kent Gardner, help me understand now. We've heard from labor. But Jeb Bush said it's about part-time workers who want to work full-time but aren't and can't in the current conditions. What do you make of it as an economist?
Well, Evan, I think we got enough issues on the table here for about 2 weeks worth of conversations.
I know. I apologize.
So
for that.
let me go back to the statistics. I'm a numbers guy, and I think there are a few statistics that are important to put on the table. One is that workers' participation rates, the workforce participation rates, are way down. And, we can get into the many, many reasons for that. But if you look at men in particular, if you take a look at, going back to 1948, which is as far back as our series takes us, workforce participation with men was 89%. That's people over the age of 16 who could be part of the workforce. 87% were in the workforce. That has been declining. It's down to about 69% now.
Isn't that kind of normally expected based on sort of societal and changing gender expectations? Is that possible?
Well, the fact that men are working less, I suppose it reflects the fact that women are working more.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I do think you need to take a look at men and women differently. I think that many of the changes we've seen, again, it strays into a lot of different areas, but many of the changes I think we've seen in the workforce, loss of manufacturing jobs, a lot of the industries that have been particularly hit by technology are industries that where the occupations tend to be disproportionately occupied by men. So there are a lot of different issues going on there. But certainly the decline in workforce participation for men is one number. In terms of the number of people who are working part-time who would like to be working full-time, as Bush said, it's at this point it's about 6.5 million. That number has actually been coming down, thankfully. It peaked at near 6% in 2009-10, the peak of the recession. It's been declining now. It's down to about 4.1% of the labor force. So that certainly is a problem, and it's kind of the problem of the economy. How do you get people working again? How do you get people back into the workforce who would like to be back in the workforce?
Okay. So in other words, it sounds to me like I think you would disagree with Jim Bertolone that Jeb Bush was 0% right. Jim couldn't find anything that he disagreed that he agreed with Bush on there.
Yeah, I think, Bush's numbers in terms of workforce participation and the number of people who are working part-time who want full-time work, those numbers are correct. I mean, those are, Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers. And I think they're very worrisome. The reasons for them, I'm sure Jim and I would, disagree across the board about some of the reasons. But certainly, I think technology is one of the most significant ones. Conversation also gets deeply mixed in with globalization, which is another component, which is related to, lots of other worldwide trends in terms of democracy, and which, of course, our political scientists might have more to say about.
Well, before I kick it over to Sean Sutton,
sure.
More point.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeb Bush did say he blamed in part the part-time workers who can't get full-time jobs on the Affordable Care Act, but also the new overtime rules. And if you missed that last week, a lot of conversation about that. Essentially, anybody making, is it 52,000 or less, is eligible for overtime under the new rules. And Jeb Bush is saying you're going to force employers to turn 40-hour workers into 30-hour workers now because of that. Aaron Young saying he's got it backwards. It's the other way around. They'll have incentive to make part-timers full-time. What do you make of it?
You know, Aaron, I'm sorry. I think that the incentives work in the opposite direction. It doesn't mean that it's a bad decision, but if you look at the incentives from a workplace perspective, I think if a worker becomes more expensive on an hourly basis as a consequence of the change in the rule, there's an incentive to hire fewer of those hours. And so an employer, and you know, I'm not talking about, you know, we could, you know, impugn the motivation of employers morally, but nonetheless, that is where the incentives lead. We make decisions sometimes that are good decisions that have consequences, and sometimes those consequences aren't great. We have to make public policy decisions, and sometimes there's breakage. You know, there's kind of incidental damage that occurs as a result.
So, Aaron, just a brief explanation. Why do you think that it does work the other way? Why do you think the new overtime rules would incentivize employers to make part-timers full-time?
One of the things that labor has done is we have scrutinized how this has gone in the employer-employee relationship across the country and how this has led to the decline of the middle class. That led to the conversation that you and I had prior to coming here mm-hmm. and in response to Jeb Bush's comments. And again, I will bring up wage stagnation. What we're looking at numbers-wise is that not enough adjustments have been made since the 70s. Jim also just brought that up as well. And you look at the fact that, you know, 40 years ago, over 60% of employees qualified for overtime. And today that number is 11%. Where are we going here? This is not a way to sustain the middle class and therefore is detrimental to the economy.
But the consequence of that, Aaron, could be some loss of full-time workers. It's not going to go the other direction. That's, I think, the simple point here is that, you know, for those people who are working, who deserve to be getting overtime for the work that they're doing, I think on any kind of moral level, you know, that's fine. But there are going to be some people who are going to be pushed into the part-time ranks.
But
that is where the incentive falls.
We are talking about two groups of people in this country right now that we can't ignore. One is the overworked and the other is the underemployed.
There's no disagreement that those people deserve attention. It's a very simple point. The incentive to employers, I think, from the rule is going to be to push more people to part-time work. And that may be collaborative, collateral damage that we're willing to accept. It's just that is where the incentive lies.
In order to sustain the productivity level that employers currently have, the work needs to get done either way. So if you're talking about a cost per hour for an employee, adjusting these overtime rules then is, again, the work needs to get done. An employer is going to have incentive to either cough up that money or look at a part-time worker and offer them a full-time position at the regular wage that they pay.
In other words, Aaron, you're saying if that work's got to get done, I don't want to pay time and a half. I just want to pay time. I want to pay regular
exactly.
rate. Ken, is that wrong?
Oh, of course, that's absolutely correct, and that's why you're going to have an incentive to do less overtime. And so you're going to see people, employers attempting to avoid paying overtime. And overtime is really expensive, so they're going to rather have more people on a regular rate than paying overtime.
So then you just proved my original point that it's the other way around. Adjusting the overtime rules is going to give employers more incentive to offer full-time work for part-time. And Jeb Bush is saying that it is not.
Well, it doesn't connect with me, Aaron. I'm sorry, but you know, I think we'll just agree to disagree.
Okay. I want to ask Sean Sutton from RIT, the chair of political science there. After all of this, and I think what we're having here, Kent is right, we're having a discussion that could probably go for hours or days. And unfortunately, nuance is often lost in American media. So Sean Sutton, here's Time Magazine's headline after that last week. Jeb Bush's longer hours comment will haunt him. It's a gaffe, even if he tried to clarify it. Is this going to haunt him?
No, I don't think it's going to haunt him. I think the most important thing that he's done is that he's started to raise the question that the economy is suffering from underemployment. I wish he had moved even further and said that there was hidden unemployment. But either way, all of those possibilities are in his wheelhouse. He's there first. Everyone else in his party is talking about Donald Trump. He's at least come out and is touched upon, I think, one of the most important issues, and that is the unemployment question and the underemployment question. And so I think he'll be fine on that issue. Where he'll probably run into trouble is just simply emphasizing economic growth and not taking into account the issue that Bernie Sanders has brought up, which is very obviously resonates with the people, and that is that there's income inequalities that are serious and chronic and have to be addressed. Whether or not he can do that will be very interesting to see. But I don't see that this is something that's going to harm him. I think he's set himself up to at least be the first out the box to start talking about the question that resonates with the American people.
Well, before I get to your phone calls, a question on productivity. That's a term that's come up a couple times. And a study released, and this Time magazine cited this one, a study released this year from the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute found worker productivity rose 74% between 1973 and 2013. Wages were up only 9%. In other words, Americans were doing more work with very little increase in their compensation. Kent, do those numbers square with you as an economist?
Yeah, they do. They're it's a very worrisome trend to see that decline in productivity. Again, I think it's important to understand why that has happened. And again, it comes down to technology and globalization. So the issue of declining productivity, it's not a matter of workers not working all well, not working smart, not working hard. It's not about the workers. It's really about the kind of competition that workers confront worldwide. That's been particularly true for people, low-skilled, semi-skilled, because of the barriers that fell down with the collapse of the Soviet Union and many, many other changes that happened in the last century. You know, now the American worker is competing with everyone globally, and it's a pretty tough labor market out there.
Jim Bertolone?
I got to say, I agree with Kent to a large extent with the globalization. We talked about the underemployed males, and when you talk about 60,000 factories closing since 2001, 50,000 under George W. Bush, and those jobs going offshore, and about half of those 5 to 6 million jobs are due to technology. But one of the problems with that is for most of the 20th and 21st century, and still today, the majority of our patents are new jobs. They come out of manufacturing. And when the manufacturing goes offshore, the R&D goes with it. And so the new jobs created by technology, too often when the factory goes offshore, those jobs go offshore as well. And I think there's another male-dominated, when you talk about unemployment, that we keep missing, that the stimulus hit a little bit, our infrastructure. I mean, this is something that even Trumka from Labor and Tom Donohue from the Chamber of Commerce had a joint press conference last year, and both agreed we need a minimum of $2 to $3 trillion in infrastructure. Of course, Tom Donohue doesn't want to raise taxes to pay for it, but our highways are 1950s. Our train system is mostly 1940s and 50s. Our airports are 1970s. Our bridges are all hitting 50 years old. And again, construction tends to be a male-dominated industry. And if the spigot ever turns on to put people to work for our infrastructure, something that the private sector doesn't pay for or do, that government does, that could change the dynamics as far as the underemployed males in this country.
Kent, thoughts on that?
It certainly, I completely agree that we need to be investing in infrastructure. We've been ignoring infrastructure for a long time. It's a real problem, and I would certainly support an increase in taxation that would cover that. We're into a really difficult political dynamic here. I think we've painted ourselves into a corner, and I think it's a difficult place to get out. But absolutely, if we were to spend more on infrastructure, we would see that disproportionately help you know, those unemployed males.
We're going to get to the phones in the second half hour. If you're waiting on the phones, we will be coming to you. David, Don, Carlene, John, we're coming to you in just a couple of minutes. I also wanted to ask Kent Gardner and Sean Sutton about kind of a political football, but it's also hopefully a substance football, and that's the question of the Affordable Care Act. And Sean, first of all, to you, to your side of things, evaluating sort of the politics of this, Jeb Bush is attacking the Affordable Care Act and saying that it is hurting workers because it's pushing employers to turn them from full-time workers into part-time workers. He clearly thinks there's still a big advantage, at least in the primaries, of attacking the Affordable Care Act. Are we going to see that continue?
Yes, I think he'll have to run that one all the way to the election if he's the nominee. But a more interesting aspect to that is presidents can make those sorts of claims all they want, but at the end of the day, they've got to hope that Congress can pull this off for them, and that would require 60 votes in the Senate to help out, and I'm not sure that this is an election that's going to give him a Congress that'll be that friendly.
Probably not happening. I mean, when the Supreme Court ruled on the Affordable Care Act 6-3, a lot of the analysis out there from people much smarter than I am said that, boy, Republicans are thrilled with this because they don't have to wear it. They can claim it's a bad decision, but they don't have to deal with the actual implications of carrying it out.
I think it's actually, you know, it's really a wonderful opportunity. I mean, Bush can campaign against the Affordable Care Act all he likes. And as you point out, Sean, nothing can happen. and I think if he actually had to put a bill on, you know, had to actually pass and sign a bill that would take away, for example, access for young people to age 26 or to, you know, go back on, you know, the ban on pre-existing conditions or many of the other things in the Affordable Care Act that individually poll very positively, I think he'd have a real political problem.
You agree, Sean?
Yeah, I agree. That'll be the hardest thing for him to sell if he's the president. But right now it's an issue. He's going to beat that drum all the way to November. 400 and something days from now.
Oh boy,
he's starting to count.
But what's the interesting thing? And you know, this is I find this. You know, I'm a Congress guy. Congress is the engine room of the government. Presidents can stand up and make all sorts of claims that they're going to bring about 4% economic growth, but they have to hope that Congress will play along. And so there's often something interesting and empty about presidential rhetoric. And I understand why.
Oh, I'm so sad to hear this. All this time I thought we were talking about great campaigns.
And that's the problem. For 5 years, neither Bush or the Republican Party have come up with an alternative to having 50 million people uninsured. We're still waiting for the Republican plan. I was on a phone conference with then-candidate Obama in 2008 as a regional AFL-CIO rep and our national president, Richard Trumka, where Obama said, just like every other first-world democracy, he believed in a Medicare for All system. He just didn't believe we could get there from here. And that the difference in our health care with everybody who has those systems is we pay twice as much. The administrative costs alone of between $350 and $400 billion would cover everybody in this country for Medicare. The Republicans' mantra, religion of privatization, private sector, doesn't allow them to go there, but they still have not come up with an alternative to insuring the millions of people who are uninsured.
I don't want to go too far afield. Let me just, I know, Aaron, you want to jump in. I just want to redirect for one moment because the reason the ACA came up in Jeb Bush's remarks was the question of whether substantively do we know now that employers are moving more full-time workers to part-time because of the ACA. Jake writes to the program and says, the ACA has been in effect long enough now. Are there any statistics that actually show employers limiting hours in response, or is that just speculation? Kent Gardner.
There are some anecdotes that suggest that that's true for some employers. I mean, this is like most questions on public policy. You know, it's true in part and false in part. It's not we've not seen dramatic reductions in full-time work as a consequence, but nonetheless, there is that incentive for some employers. Some employers will take advantage of this loophole.
Okay. Aaron?
Well, I just wanted to make a general blanket statement to wrap the two together. As far as the ACA goes, I was a single mother with a child who survived brain cancer. And luckily, I lived in New York State, where we have a system of health care to help people. But across the nation, I think that, A, it's fundamentally wrong for people to not have some type of access to health care, and if employers are not going to do it, we need to have that conversation. After all, many of them who do not offer or will cut hours in order to not pay benefits are the largest welfare recipients going. And I also want to make a statement that I think that there's also something wrong when more and more people are more concerned about an employer's ability to pay their bills, and they don't seem to be that concerned about anybody else's ability to pay their bills. So I think if you take both statements put together, the attention, again, is focused on the employers. And yes, we do need employment here. And yes, everybody needs to be able to pay their bills, which kind of loops this around to the beginning of our conversation about productivity levels and profits. Where is this all going? We have to answer those questions before we can really kind of take a good snapshot of what, how far down the rabbit hole this really goes in conversation. I agree. We could talk about this for 3 weeks.
Well, let's get a short break in and bring our listeners in who have questions and comments of their own. For our panel, you're hearing there Aaron Young, lead organizer for the Rochester and Genesee Valley Labor Federation. Jim Bertolone's here as well from AFL-CIO. Kent Gardner, the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. And Sean Sutton, the chair of political science at RIT. Short break. Your questions and comments on the phone next. Coming up in our second hour, we know that violence impacts the lives of children, but a new look at the issue finds that more kids are impacted by violence than you probably think, and it is not just a stereotypical category of children who can be impacted for life by violence. We'll talk to some experts who have been working on this issue for years and take your comments as well next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. And the last point before we hit to the phones, we were just discussing during the break that question that Jeb Bush raised regarding, are we forcing full-time workers to part-time due to the Affordable Care Act? I said during the break, I can think of an employer in town that I know, not my current employer, certainly, that has blamed the ACA for moving workers in that direction. Again, that's just an anecdote. That's not a study or a statistic. And Kent Gardner, the chief economist for CGR, was saying, there are anecdotes like that. There isn't one big number that says Jeb Bush was right about that, but there are a lot of anecdotes out there. But Kent, you're saying even if it is true, it might be part of the value discussion we have about whether it's worth it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we make decisions that have got a collateral damage. You do it anyway, even if all of the effects aren't positive. You know, there are very, very few big decisions you can make that don't have winners and losers, and you just have to stack them up and make your decision.
Jim Bertolone?
I would say when you get to this and you're talking about, again, going back to Medicare for All, labor here belongs to two labor management groups, the American Association Alliance of Manufacturing and the Coalition of Prosperous America. And the manufacturers, which include Corning Glass, Revere Copper, a number of others, they are competing, as Kent said, in the global economy. Our American companies have the cost of health care on their back, and most of the people we compete with do not. I mean, the most well-known example, I think, is the auto industry, where it adds, on average, $1,500 a car here to the cost of a vehicle in the manufacturing, where right across the Great Lakes in Canada, the government, the General Motors, takes a big ad out in the newspaper every year thanking the Canadian government for their health care system that is taking those costs off of the backs of manufacturers in Canada. So I think that's the key part here, is that our employers still have this cost in production, and the rest of the first world does not, for the most part.
Let me get to your phone calls. And David in Pittsford is first. Go ahead, David.
From listening to Jeb Bush's comments, it's fairly clear he doesn't know the difference between productivity and production. More workers will give you more production, generally, but won't change the productivity at all. And thinking that somebody who doesn't understand something this basic as president is pretty scary.
David, thanks for the phone call. Let me ask the economist. You want to validate what David is saying there? We've lost David already. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure I understand what David's point is. I mean, you know, clearly if you take the same work and you divide it by more workers, productivity is going to decline. You know, one of the challenges, I think, for the American economy is that we're, you know, eager to boost productivity and boost employment at the same time. And frankly, sometimes that's hard to do. We've seen a tremendous increase in productivity as a consequence of technology, and one of the outcomes of that has been that we hire fewer workers.
Labor, want to respond to that?
I think all things being equal, a lot of this is driven by demand. I mean, if you need 1,000 work hours to get the job done, and the demand is there to create 1,000 work hours, chances are this type of rule change will, as Aaron said earlier, if it decreases over time, it will increase. There will be a tendency to increase the part-time work to more hours. Normally, you're not going to get more hiring unless demand increases, and it would just be to shift the economics where workers who are working more than 40 hours a week would have more leisure time, and people who were working 30 hours a week for straight time would brought up again based on the demand and that particular industry. And I think it's also important to know that according to most out there, the new rule is only an adjustment for inflation, that the overtime rule at 23,000 in change being brought up to a little under 51,000 from 75 just reflects the inflation as where it should be.
Okay, let me get back to the phones then. And this is Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I think this was Jeb Bush's Mitt Romney moment when Mitt Romney made his comment about the 47%. I don't think it was a gaffe, though. I think that because he was giving an interview to the Manchester Union Leader, which is one of the most conservative newspapers in the country. In the 70s, we used to call it the Manchester Onion Loader because it was so right-wing for some reason or other. I don't think it's a gaffe. I think this is what he really believes. Paul Krugman in today's New York Times talks about what Jeb Bush said, and he says that American workers work 30% more hours over the course of a year than their German counterparts. He calls the title of his column is The Laziness Dogma, and he says that it's the dogma of the Republican Party, has been for quite some time. When he talks like this about the laziness of the American worker...
Jeb Bush didn't use the word lazy, though, Don. I do want to say that. I mean, I understand that some projected that. He did not... Okay, okay.
Paul Krugman does. And by implying that this is the laziness of the American worker, he's using it as a fig leaf to make big cutbacks in programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the whole gamut, right down the line. By implying that the American workers are lazy, he's getting it into their head that the American workers don't deserve what they have earned, and he's going to cut it back, him and his Republican cohort.
All right, Don, thanks for the call. I suspect we may have a little bit of disagreement now on the panel. First of all, Sean Sutton, he says this is the Mitt Romney moment, the 47%, it's going to drag him down. You said earlier you don't think this will be a long-lasting gaffe.
No, I don't see that this is a long-lasting gaffe at all. I think that Jeb Bush has set himself up, I said it before, to discuss the salient question facing the economy, and that is underemployment and unemployment. The question of Americans not working hard enough, I do see that there's a certain element of a dogma there for the Republican Party, but I can't see that Jeb Bush is going to unveil or even attempt to cut back on welfare and all the other subsidies that so-called libertarians and conservatives think that we're living on so that we don't have to work. I can't see that happening.
Okay. Kent Gardner, do you agree with Don? Did you take Jeb Bush's comment saying that American workers are lazy?
You know, I cannot conceive in my wildest imagination that Jeb Bush would say that. It just is inconceivable, and it has not been a theme for Republicans. I just challenge anyone to show me a collection of statements from Republicans arguing that workers are lazy. I mean, I think, you know, the most obvious example, the most obvious explanation of his comment is the one that he made, which is to say that we got too many people working part-time, we'd like to work full-time. I mean, it's very well known by, you know, across the spectrum that Americans work harder than, you know, most anybody else in terms of hours, at least work harder than anybody else in the world.
Jim Bertolone and Aaron Young. Jim?
The gaffe, and I agree with Sean, the gaffe won't last, but the reason is, as you pointed out earlier, Evan, it's 16 months away from the election. The phrase clown car has already become our vernacular of two dozen Republican candidates, and it's hard to see any gaffe sticking as long as you got Donald Trump and a few others in the race. You're
okay,
going to hear a lot of things.
But hold on. Let's not go too far. Do you agree with Don, and do you agree with Paul Krugman? Did you take that comment, Jim, that Jeb Bush is implying that workers are lazy?
No, I did take it, and this much I agree with Krugman, that it's the same top-down philosophy, that, you know, if we increase GDP and if workers increase productivity, there'll be less wealth inequality. Well, for 3.5 decades, we've been hearing that, so it's another version of supply side, and it's not happening.
But if he didn't mean that workers were lazy, then his explanation seems to hold water.
Right. He's still just talking supply side. He's not saying workers are lazy, but he is, in our view, in labor's view, expounding the same failed economic policies, top-down economic policies we've heard for many, many years.
Okay, I think that's where the disagreement is. The disagreement here, I think the notion of laziness is sort of a red herring. I think the disagreement is Jeb Bush is saying too many workers in this country want to be full-time and they're part-time. 6.5 million is the number he used. Kent,
right.
That's largely accurate.
That's the most recent number. That's
okay.
Correct.
Yeah. And then the question becomes why? And Jeb Bush says new overtime rules, Affordable Care Act, and Aaron and Jim are saying wrong. There have been a long-standing series of failed policies that seem to benefit the top and not workers across the board. So I don't think it's about being lazy. I think it's looking at what is the prescription for fixing this problem that everyone seems to agree does exist.
That's really the substantive discussion we should be having, not whether Jeb Bush meant that workers were lazy.
But maybe Sean Sutton, even though you say he's not going to wear it, Democrats are going to try to make him wear it. It sounds like there will be ads probably with, you know, Mitt Romney said corporations are people. We saw that in ads all the time, and maybe deservedly so. But we're probably going to see this in ads, is what I'm saying. It sounds like to me.
Yeah, well, sure, you'll see it in ads, but I don't think this one's going to stick. I think he's going to start making the case for we need to address underemployment, unemployment. But, you know, let's also raise another question, and that is, you know, you pointed out that we do have a large number of people on part-time employment. Perhaps it's not due to overtime rules. Perhaps it's not due to the Health Care Act. Perhaps it could be due to structural changes in the economy that are actually more deeply troubling that we won't see brought up seriously in a presidential election because, well, presidential elections are not altogether all that serious. So
I agree with that.
I think that's those sorts of structural questions, I think, are the most interesting, but the least discussed.
Because they're the least sexy and the hardest to encapsulate in 30 seconds or less. And consultants across this country have been saying that Americans can't handle more than 60 seconds of news in a single subject at one time. Thank goodness they are wrong. Let's go back to the phones, and this is Carlene in Rochester. Go ahead, Carlene.
Yes. I think we're sort of missing the point here. When he was talking about that, let's take a look at our educational institutions, for instance, the college system. If you look at how many adjuncts and part-timers there are, there's policy involved in this. U of R locally is one of the highest that has full-time employees. Some of our other MCC, et cetera, the other universities have as high as 40-some percent are adjunct and part-timers. Now, this is policy that's set in one specific area, and this is so they don't have to pay benefits. And it's well known, it's been known for decades. This is nothing new. And there are some other fields this is true in. It could be true at Walmart. What I would love to see is all these great minds identify 10, 20, 30 industries where we can bring jobs back and reinaugurate education of young people in certain areas, not just shovel-ready jobs or construction. And there's a whole myriad of people in this economy that would like to do diversified work. So, but I think you're missing the point here. If they go full time, as Jeb Bush suggests, those benefits will be astounding that they'd have to pay. So it isn't comparing. I don't think you folks are comparing the right things. You've got to look at how do we bring certain level of industry and jobs, not what we once had, but what can we enhance to bring and build a workforce here in the United States right now.
Carlin, thanks for the phone call. Jim and Aaron, I want to start with you. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we have the workforce. One of the things that's not getting a lot of play on discussion of immigration, for example. In the last 6 months, we've seen huge downsizing out in the West Coast on the aerospace industry under the H-2 visa program. I testified at RIT several years ago. The U.S. Senate Commission on Trade with China came in, and much of that testimony there and data showed that after the manufacturing jobs, the last few years, it's been the white-collar education jobs that have gone, that require college degrees that have gone offshore in droves, whether it's medical technicians or CPAs or R&D. So, again, we could have a huge discussion of globalization and where the problems are structurally in our economy. But taking a half a step back here, going back to the overtime policies and other things, I think we also have to keep a historical context. I mean, you can go back well over a century, and I don't care if it still goes on today, whether it's the minimum wage, whether it's Medicare, whether it's the 40-hour work week and time and a half, whether it's Social Security. For the Chamber of Commerce, should be called the Chamber of Chicken Little. The sky is always falling. You raise the minimum wage, everybody's going to get thrown out of work. You pay time and a half, inflation's going to go up. We've been hearing that since 2009 of how inflation's going to be up if we don't do something with the deficit. It hasn't happened. Medicare, when Kennedy introduced Medicare in 1962, Ronald Reagan was making broadcasts and recordings of how we were going to wake up in the Soviet Union with the loss of our freedom. You know, anytime you try to do something for working people, increase their wages, address wealth inequality, make the minimum wage a living wage, we hear all the sky is falling stuff. And it just historically has never, never, never happened.
Okay. Kent Gardner, you want to respond to some of that?
Well, I think getting back to Carlene's point,
yeah.
she was talking specifically about benefits.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jim had mentioned earlier the difference between, you know, how the U.S. auto firms and the Canadian auto firms are competing on a different basis because we have health insurance that's paid centrally. And, you know, I agree with that. I think that and certainly health benefits do play a role in the hiring decisions of individual employers. And again, that's why there's collateral damage associated with the Affordable Care Act. It's because it is expensive. And if you require workers or require employers to pay health care for full-time but not for part-time, then there is an incentive for them to move more towards part-time. So I think if we did move towards some sort of a centrally managed, centrally paid healthcare system, that we would take that off the table and we would make it easier for people to work. Not just that we would see more people working full-time, but we would perhaps break this notion that there's either full-time or there's part-time. And realistically, in this economy, each of us should be able to say, well, you know, I'm really kind of a 30-hour-a-week guy. You know, I'd like to work more than the 15 hours I've got now. Maybe I don't want to work 40 hours. And unfortunately, the way the labor whole labor market is structured right now, you know, we've got this dichotomous choice. You know, you can work full-time or not. And the or not is often not very desirable. So I do think that taking benefits off the table could make a difference.
John and Hamlin, let's keep it moving as fast as we can. John, go ahead.
Yeah, well, earlier Kent made a comment about the technology and globalization. I'll give him that. But what I don't think anybody on the panel has talked about so far is the increase in the pay for people people at the top, the CEOs, the CFOs, whatever they are, because that seems to be have increased, I don't know, exponentially in the fact that they've gotten a lot of increase where the workers at the bottom haven't. You got a guy like Duda that retired from Blue Cross Blue Shield a few years back. He got a $6 million parachute. Are you kidding me? I mean, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Excellus, I mean, they're supposed to be doing this at a better rate than, say, a for-profit company and stuff. And yet they're putting their advertising on hockey games and everything else and on the thing to get more subscribers. And yet that's what's driving up the medical costs and stuff.
All right, John.
You know, Medicare for all would be much cheaper administratively than what we're doing right now.
John, thanks for the call. You're reflecting what I hear from a lot of people, which is frustration and executive pay. Mm-hmm. Kent, is that a red herring or is that a fair issue to discuss here?
Well, two answers, Evan. You know, I think it's complicated. It should be in my tombstone. the executive pay. If you take if you took the salaries being paid and retirement paid out to people at the top at Excellus and you spread it out across all the ratepayers, unfortunately, it wouldn't make a big difference. That's not to say that I think that those are legitimate and appropriate rates to pay people. So I do think that executive compensation is way out of range. I don't know how to rein it in. You know, from a policy perspective, the Securities and Exchange Commission some years ago decided that they were upset about where executive pay was going. So they passed a change, and they said that that publicly traded companies had to reveal what their executives were making. And their expectation was that as soon as the public and the people who own stock looked at what the executives were paying, they'd say, well, that's ridiculous. They should get less money. Instead, what happened is that all the executives could see what all the other executives were making, and salaries went up.
Mm-hmm. Jim and Aaron, Jim, you got a big smile on your face.
Well, they'd say when I became a union advocate, which is 42 years ago now, the average was about CEOs made about 35 times more than their average worker. And I've seen everything from a low of 320 to as high as 400 times as the average worker, depending on what policy group is studying. And I think it sends a horrible message as far as wealth inequality. But I don't think the American people and the worker begrudge high salaries to success. What they begrudge is a tax system, whether it's hedge funds, whether it's stock market, whether it's fighting a transaction tax of a penny a tax, is that money that works gets taxed at a much lower rate than workers who work. And again, whether it's wealth inequality or the minimum wage not going up for inflation, it continues to put a structural view from working class people that the system is unfair and stacked against them.
Okay. Sean Sutton, last word from you as we start to wrap up. And for all of the people who've been waiting to get through, this is just, Kent is right. We need to do this with some continuity here. We need to try to talk about the economy as sort of calmly and with as much depth as we can. Sean, what's the lesson from the last week here? I think, at least to me, it seems that at least we shouldn't try to oversimplify a single sentence of a comment made to a newspaper, and that maybe we could have a productive discussion even if we don't all agree on these things. What do you think?
I think that's true, but I think that those who are running for the presidency need to be a little bit more careful. If you're going to make the case that your policies will deal with unemployment, you should at least use the word unemployment, underemployment, to drive home just what it is that you're all about. And I think that if Jeb Bush had done that from the start, he would be in a much stronger position and people would be debating that point a little bit more positively and a lot more productively.
But I agree, because if he would have made the clarifying comments initially, he would never have been viewed as having made a gaffe. Now, Jim and Aaron would still be disagreeing with every part of that comment, but you wouldn't have Paul Krugman saying he's calling workers lazy. Kent, 20 seconds, final word from you?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it was, it wasn't a real smart use of words. I really honestly don't think he meant that. But, people will attempt to arm him with that, and that certainly is going to carry through the campaign.
Well, at least, Jim and Aaron, we're talking about underemployment, and all of the issues that I know are important to you, and we'll continue to talk about that. That at least is a positive here, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think Bush would have to have the policy smarts and the educational smarts of Ken or Sean to do that, and I don't believe he does.
Oh, boy. All right, let's get a short break in. We'll come back here a very different second hour. Thanks to our entire panel. Thanks to everyone for being here.
Thank
short
you,
break
Evan.
And
Thank
more
you.
Connections in just a moment.
Thanks, Evan.